In this episode, I interview Francisco Negrin, who's an opera director and also a director of opening shows for large events. I originally met Francisco on a train ride, an overnight train ride from Geneva to Nice. We were both recent graduates from our various universities, coming from such different backgrounds, intellectually and otherwise, but there was this extraordinary exchange that took place where I learned an enormous amount about theater and literature and film. And I don't think Francisco learned much about anything else, but it was certainly very inspiring for me. And for reasons I don't fully understand, the friendship has endured in spite of having extraordinarily different lives. I've managed to connect with Francisco in various cities, including Barcelona, in Glasgow, where he lived for a while, London, and New York, where, because he travels for more than half the year directing operas on various stages. I think that somebody who lives, Francisco has extraordinary experiences around management. He is perhaps more challenged than any business CEO because he has to manage talents who are volatile and have strong emotions, and there is no way around the talent in a certain way. Once you've practiced an opera with a particular singer, it's not going to be easy to replace them. And so he has extraordinary insights and extraordinary challenges. And I also really appreciate and think that we all should support those of us who live in the world of culture. Culture is not just something for me. It's not something on the side that is an ornament. Culture is the product of our deep subconscious, and people who live in the artistic world are in touch with humanity's collective subconscious in a way that the rest of us aren't, but the rest of us can access it by engaging with the art that they produce. And so I hope that you enjoy my conversation with Francisco, which covers all of the questions that I still have about the artistic world and some questions about management. And you'll get an insight into a personality who's behind some of the most innovative and interesting operatic and theatre productions that we see today. Enjoy the conversation with Francisco Negrin. Francisco, say hello to the audience.
Hi, audience. And hello, Guy. Thanks for having me on here.
Yeah, so there you go. He's a man of few words. And so what I want to do is have Francisco tell the story of how Francisco and I met, which is kind of funny in itself. Why don't I put you on the spot? Go ahead, Francisco.
Yeah, it is a good story, actually. I can't remember why I was in Switzerland, but I guess because I was working with this director you mentioned, François Rocher, Swiss theater and opera director. And I was going back home to the South of France, and I was traveling by train, had booked a couchette in a cabin where with several, no, there were six, I think. And Guy was one of the people in the other couchettes. And we started talking through the whole night ride, talking and talking and talking. It lasted the whole night. And the next day, actually, one of the people who was sleeping underneath us actually said, when we all woke up, she woke up and she said, "Well, did you reinvent the world then?" Well, and that was, as I remember the story anyway.
Well, I guess my experience was that I was on one of my Euro tours where you could spend 200 French francs and get 3 months worth of free train rides in Europe as a European citizen. And I had never come across somebody who saw the world so differently to me and had insights into parts of the world that I had no clue about. And I subsequently stayed in touch with Francisco and visited him and his then partner in Scotland, in Glasgow, certainly met up with Francisco in London. And when I married a Mexican, certainly introduced Francisco to my Mexican wife, and there was a connection there. But somehow, in spite of his extraordinary travel, and I've even met up with Francisco in New York City, where at least once we've had dinner with Francisco's brother, who lives in the U.S. And so there are a couple of connections for me to Francisco. One is that we're both kind of stateless in that we are participants in multiple cultures and have multiple nationalities or nomad nationalities. But the other connection, and perhaps that's where I kind of want to start off with you, Francisco, is that it turns out, actually reading some of the material on you, that you at high school in Antibes studied maths and physics. And I'd imagined you to be an art student. And I didn't realize that there's this kind of... So perhaps can you explain why you ended up in maths and physics in high school and not in the arts, which is where you've ended up professionally?
Well, for two reasons. First of all, I realize now as an adult that I'm extremely interested in science and that I find there is a beautiful place where science and art meet, and that it's the most useful part, I think, of both of those ways of thinking and disciplines, where science really uses intuition and uses even the concept of beauty as a guide to great advances and new ways of thinking, and where the rigors of science are applied to art to give it structure and form. So probably unconsciously, I was drawn to studying that. But also there's a more pragmatic side that in the French education system, it's very strange also being France, where art, it's actually one of the few countries where art is really comes with prestige. There, for some reason in the education system, if you study languages or arts, you then don't have much choice of where you continue your studies on the university level. Whereas if you do maths and physics, then you can choose anything. So as I was able to do maths and physics, and I was relatively interested at the time, I thought better follow that path because then I'll be able to do what I want. So then I was able then to really concentrate on the arts, having had the choice to do other things as well. And it was a major thing in my formation, really, because as I said, I arrived in the arts world with a certain amount of scientific baggage and knowledge and interest.
And as my understanding, not having been through the French system, it's especially in sciences, even at high school, is extraordinarily rigorous. I'm sure that you would have thought about and had the opportunity to go and do École Préparatoire and Grande École. Did that world ever attract you?
No, because as soon as I finished high school, I knew very well I wanted to go into the arts, and that my preparation in high school with maths and physics had just been primarily a way to not close any doors. But I think what I got there of the maths and physics was sufficient. And what I really needed at that point was the arts, because having studied maths and physics in high school, the amount of hours allocated for the humanities was very low. So I was craving it by then.
So if I had been your father, Francisco, and I'd said, look, you can go to École Polytechnique, you know, École des Ponts et Chaussées, École Normale Supérieure. I mean, you would have known. How would you have responded to me?
I would have still gone where I wanted, I think, because I was lucky not to have you as a father then. and my parents, being artists themselves, you know, were never going to get in the way of my true nature, as it were.
Now, the guy that I met on the train had already been, and I don't know what point in your career you were at, had already been a voracious reader of the humanities. While you were studying sciences at school, were you reading on the side?
Yeah, I have really bad memory. I live a lot in the present, but yeah, I assume so. I've always been very curious. I guess it's my biggest quality and my worst fault as well. I'm extremely curious. So whenever I see anything, I then immediately want to read more about it. I get a bit obsessive on a theme or an author or any kind of subject. So I sort of go down a rabbit hole, and I like to go quite deep into things. So I'm sure in my adolescence, I was definitely immersing myself in all sorts of things, philosophy in particular, music, of course, history of art. And again, as I was getting all the maths and physics at school anyway, I'm sure it was more in that direction that I was leaning. I wonder now how I ever had time to read all the things I read and listen to all the things I listened to. And I think, and it's quite interesting that nowadays, I mean, not just because we're adults and professionals and have responsibilities and all of that, but just the way is made, the way the world is made now, we are much more distracted by television, internet, what have you, other, you know, other media that are easier. And so we actually waste a lot more time watching and reading fluff. Whereas I guess when I was on lesson to none of that existed, you know, I actually had to go to a library and get a book or, you know, ask people and have long conversations. And I'm very thankful for that. And I wonder what happens with the very young generations now, if they do actually get the same opportunity to dive deep into things. I don't know.
It's a great question.
Young adults in your family, so you can tell me more.
Yeah, you're welcome to turn the question back on me, but I'm going to let you. I'm not going to let you do it just yet. Before we leave the topic of maths and physics, and I can tell you that I studied maths and physics at high school. I kind of regret not doing them at university, and have started re-engaging just a little bit with mathematics. If there's one or two ideas from mathematics that you find particularly beautiful or attractive or come back to you from time to time, this is putting Francisco completely on the spot. He's had no preparation for this, so I'm curious if anything comes up for you.
I think it wouldn't be maths, and it wouldn't be from that period. It would be physics and cosmology, I guess, because of things I've read a bit later when I was already in university. All, you know, works by, you know, Carl Sagan, obviously Stephen Hawking, Brian Greene, people like that, who really are the ones who look at the universe from as far away as possible, you know, that really have the wide view and the tiny, tiny, ultra-microscopic view as well, of really how the universe works as a whole. And so the ideas, you know, of quantum physics, string theory, that kind of extremely beautiful, nearly incomprehensible way of understanding what we're made of and what, you know, is common to everything around us, including ourselves, that completely fascinates me and really is inside my work as an artist.
Yeah, sort of like what the hell is going on?
Yeah, the why, how, you know, those questions that apparently asked a lot when I was a kid.
It reminds me of a question that Jordan Peterson, that I've watched and read quite a bit of him recently. He says, you know, well, the universe and the world, it's really quite a strange place, he says, in his sort of like inimical Canadian accent. But so I'm going to get on to opera, but I just want to ask you, in one of the articles that I just was reviewing before we got onto this call, it talks about, I know Spanish, French, English, but it talks to you about you having four languages, and I'm curious what the fourth language is.
It's Italian because of opera, and you know what? I never learned Italian. I actually supposedly did a term of Italian at university, but I don't think I went to any classes. And it just happened. I just, for some reason, I understand and speak Italian quite well, not having learned it. And I guess it's just, you know, the great majority of operas is in Italian. Not all of them by any means, but a lot of them. And just by studying those texts, you know, and speaking, obviously, other Latin languages, it just happened. And I'm quite happy I didn't have to actually go through the process of learning it consciously. Like the other languages, actually, I'm very lucky because, you know, people say, oh, you're amazing, you speak so many languages and really well and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, actually, I can't take any credit for it because I never went through the trouble of learning them. I was, you know, kind of raised speaking them. So it was effortless. And for that, I thank my parents a lot, you know, and I think it's the greatest tool they gave me of all of them.
There's an interesting study that I can't cite specifically that I believe that I read. So I'm expressing an idea without taking responsibility for it being true. I believe it is true, but the people who pick up languages the way you did by osmosis, when you put them in an MRI speaking those different languages, the same part of the brain lights up. Whereas people who learned language in an academic setting, a very different part of the brain lights up, apparently. Yeah. So
I'm not surprised.
And
actually, I think I'm not that good at learning new languages, because whenever I've tried, you know, I mean, obviously I get things very fast, you know, because I can, you know, my brain is used to thinking in different ways and can understand different language structures. So I can get things faster, but in actually learning them properly, like I've lived in Catalonia for like 15 years now, and I don't actually speak Catalan. I understand it perfectly well, but, you know, people who have had to learn languages, who have gone through the trouble of actually learning them, then they're really amazing at learning other languages very fast. So, and that I'm good at guessing languages, but not learning them properly.
I don't know if, as you, somebody who hasn't learned languages academically, will engage with this thought at all. It was last brought up to me by my daughter, and it's an idea from linguistics that the language shapes thought. And so learning a particular language or the grammar of a language will actually shape the way you think. And
no, it doesn't. I think actually that we're luckier, those who've learned languages through osmosis, as you said, because then you really have those completely different thought patterns ingrained in you. Whereas learning them is great, you can apply them, but they're not part of your nature. Yeah, you have to apply this other thought process. And some people are really brilliant at it, and I admire them. But when you've just have them as part of your culture yourself, then it's extremely powerful. And I find it really hard sometimes to remember that other people haven't had this privilege that I've had. And I get very irritated when people don't seem to get other cultures, you know, and when they're in another country among, and even not just country cultures, but it can be social difference cultures, you know, just worldview differences. I find it very easy to be chameleonic and adapt and understand and be sympathetic to all sorts of ways of functioning. And I get very, very impatient with people who do not have that kind of, I don't know if the word is tolerance, or, you know, ability to blend in, as it were. I totally cannot understand nationalism, or, you know, getting all excited because the football team from one particular country, you know, is going to beat another one. I can't understand it. I just don't understand what it means, where it comes from.
I don't know if you remember, apropos of that, at around the time that I'd met you, I don't think that I'd been once to the United States, and you already had been. And you described, even though it's an English-speaking country, you described the United States as being, I don't know if you remember what you said, and now I need to remember, because I'm the one who brought up the point. But you had a description for the feeling of being in the United States, and it was to do with kind of like this vastness that kind of thoughts just expand and explode into nowhere, that was very, very different to the European environment, where you express a thought and it's sort of crowded by many other thoughts and many other things that have gone before. Do you remember?
You know, I don't remember that, but I remember something similar that maybe we did talk about at the time, because I remember I had been in Hawaii, and I had been completely astounded by the fact that standing there on the big island, and there was a minor eruption going on, and I could see the lava coming out of the ground and, you know, making its way across the landscape, you know, burning everything and falling into the sea and making new land. And I was like, oh my God, you know, I'm in a country where I can see the creation of the world. It's that new, this country, that's still happening here, you know what I mean? I remember being amazed by that, and suddenly that making me think how young the States were, and how people in the States, in a way, mostly act in a very adolescent way, in their way of enjoying life, in their way of being afraid of certain things in life, their way of reacting even politically at times. Of receiving new ideas. There's a certain adolescence there that comes, I think, with the land and the still the these big expanses of untouched nature, the non-crowdedness physically of the country. And then indeed, I came back from Hawaii and I went straight to London. And there I was, you know, in 18th century and Victorian London, with layers and layers of thought and architecture and people, and obviously people were going to be thinking in a different way and giving value to different things. And there was a sense of physical tiredness to the surroundings and even to the nature around. And so I remember at one point in my adolescence, really feeling that big difference between the two cultures.
You've just expressed it far better than I ever could. And just apropos of one of the things you just said around languages, is that please, audience, note that evolved personalities like Francisco don't judge these different cultures and don't set themselves apart. Francisco doesn't say he wants to be Hawaiian and not British or Londoner or vice versa. He observes these different ways of being in a certain way. And actually, part of your fluency is not just around language, but it's finding out the part of you that's Hawaiian as much as finding out the part of you that's London. And it's kind of surprising how few people get that. It's actually, I don't want to take this into politics, but I think that one of the gratifying things of, if perhaps the only gratifying thing that I can think of, is the current conflict in Ukraine, is this kind of awakening of Ukrainian self-identity and sense of being that seems to be arising in these battles. But I'm gonna ask another question, then obviously you can comment by what I said. And I'm gonna poke you a little bit, Francisco, because I find myself speaking as to you as I am from Zurich, wishing that one of your languages was German. And I don't know, maybe your German's way better than I think it is, because I would be fascinated to see. We have basically a bunch of Romance languages mixed inside you, but I think that there's a Germanic side that needs to be amplified.
Yes, and you know, you're absolutely right. And I'm very aware of it when I'm working on German repertoire or in Germany. And now soon I'm going to be in the terrible situation of working in Germany on an opera in Russian. So that'll be totally, you know, like out of the comfort zone. And I don't like that. I love that when I'm working, say, on a French piece, you know, I'm in Spain, for example, working on a French piece, and the singers are mostly Anglo-Saxon or German, that I can be the one that, you know, gets the real feeling of the language in the piece. And in this case, the piece being in Russian, and I'll be surrounded by German people, it'd be very difficult to have that emotional control about really what is being said by the piece. So I do know that I really lack this whole Germanic culture side, though it's not that remote. And I actually feel more strongly that I really need to speak a language that is completely non-Indo-European, really. I really want to be able to speak or Arabic or Japanese or one of those languages. And I've dabbled in them a little bit, but not enough. And now, at my age, with my career, it's really hard to find the time for something as time-consuming as learning a language. It has to be immersive. You have to go to the country. You know, that's really something you can do in your adolescence and childhood in a way that it's hard to do afterwards.
Actually, one way I was just thinking, so my understanding of Scotland is that there was a huge influence from the Nordic countries, and it's possible that your time in Glasgow would allow you to connect to some of that Nordic spirit, which in somehow originates in that Germanic thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. And even more so, the country where I've worked most, and in fact, the city where I've worked most, is Copenhagen in Denmark. And if I put together all the days I've spent in Denmark working on different shows, I think I've lived for 2 years in Denmark.
Wow.
And so I have, and I've also worked in Sweden a few times and in Norway. So at least, and in Holland once. So somehow indirectly, I have been immersed a little bit in a more Nordic European way of thinking, which I love, by the way. Maybe not so much the German one. I find harder. It relates less to me, the language, the structure of the language, and maybe the way of thinking than the Scandinavian languages do. So yeah, that let's say that there's a window in my brain towards that world, which there isn't so much to the other more extremely exotic languages to me, you know, that fascinate me even more now.
You see, so I, you know, I'm so torn because I have, well, I'll ask the first and then we'll come back to this. So I'm sure you've been asked this before, and forgive me, but it is really interesting to me. Why opera? You know, and the question I've gotten written down here, so I'm going to read it out, is, did you choose opera or did opera choose you?
I don't think I chose anything ever. Or at least anything worthwhile in my life, I don't think I've chosen. And this is the basis of my worldview, I think. I think that the greatest things happen to us when we have the correct education, preparation, and openness to seize the day, as it were. I think that's the basis of anything we should ever teach our kids, is be prepared, have the skills to understand what's going around you and be open to it. And the languages are very important in that sense. So that when things come by, you can actually latch onto them and fully engage with them and learn from them and grow from them and be guided by them. And I don't think you can go wrong that way. Whereas I have found many times that when I've decided, oh, I think I should do that, or I think that's the better idea, and oh, I should go knock on that door, it either hasn't worked or it's been painful in a bad way, and certainly not as fluid and really rich and joyful as going with the flow has been.
So I think that you and I probably share this view, even though I'm a very amateur and not very knowledgeable opera goer, that in some ways opera is a kind of a microcosm of the world, and it is a reflection of what is going on. It's kind of like it's one of the most complete forms of culture because it incorporates visual, story, music, drama, but at the same time it has got a minuscule audience. And I think that I would have trouble trying to make the case to the average person at a dinner party why opera is relevant, but on some level I know that it is, in spite of all the other things that are going on, all the different kinds of more instantaneous media, and I'm sure that you've thought a lot about it. So how do you explain that?
So it's tricky. It's tricky because it's not how I would formulate the question, because I don't see opera as a medium in itself. The medium in itself would be music theater. And in that I would, you know, musicals, kabuki theater, no theater, you know, all sorts of forms we're not even aware of, where visual language, storytelling, and music, and physical human expression, so voice and body, dance, etc., all come together. So as you said, opera is one tiny subset of this bigger medium that is very universal, has gazillions of audiences, in each one in its own subset, yeah? But it is the one that's truly cathartic. It's the one medium where you can completely lose yourself sensorially and yet be really present intellectually at the same time. So like when you go dancing in a disco, you lose yourself sensorially. You go to a rock concert as well. It's an amazing experience, communal experience, everybody together feeling something physical. And then you have the very, very opposite, which would be reading a book completely intellectual, you know, looking at little symbols on the page that are remote from the idea, that is remote from the actual thing in the world, and you're alone experiencing this. Music theater genres enable you to do all of this at the same time. And so that's the answer to that. And yeah, why it's relevant? Well, that's trickier, because I don't think a medium can be relevant or not. It's what you do with it that's relevant or not. And then, you know, a pop song can be relevant, like an opera can be relevant, like a film can be relevant, like it can also be completely nonsense. It's what you do with it, what you're saying with it that is relevant, not the medium itself.
And so I'm going to, for the audience, Francisco's just getting thrown this. He has had no preparation. And so forgive me for doing this. And I don't know, maybe it'll land in your lap just fine. But somebody who's constantly on my list of people to read and study better is this guy, Marshall McLuhan, who is extremely famous for having said, the medium is the message. And then I'm also aware that there's a book called The Medium is the Massage, which perhaps Francisco can explain. And really, all I can say is that I kind of understand, I think I understand this idea that the medium is the message, but maybe you can understand better, because those of you listening, Francisco did nod, and he's not making bad faces at me. But if the medium is the message, what does that say about opera, and how does it relate to all the other different forms of media that there are out there today?
Yes, I think what Marshall McLuhan meant was that it's through form that we convey information. The medium can be anything in this case. Yes, it can be this conversation as a medium. And if I were to really explain this well, I would prepare and structure my answer for it to best convey the meaning that I'm trying to convey, and for you to best be able to receive that meaning. So it is the actual structure of my speech that will convey the message. The message in itself cannot exist unless it has a shape to be communicated through. Your computer can do nothing without the ones and the zeros.
And
so I think that's what he meant. And in that sense, I take this very far. And you know this because of a talk that you asked me to do once that I tried to do in Switzerland.
People who were not very switched on to anything much than trying to make more money, I think. But anyway.
And that talk was meant to be about structure, because indeed the message is the medium. And in everything I see around us, and in everything I try to do in my work, I realize that it's the structure of it that is the most essential and most important part. I always give the example of a building that is successful is a building that where you can understand as you enter it, you know, what you're entering and where you're meant to go next and what feeling you're going to have and what information is going to be conveyed by the journey you make through the building and how the space is conceived for each of the activities that has to take place in this building. So the building in itself is already giving you a bunch of information that is not just intellectual, but is physical. And we're back to this sort of catharsis I was talking about in music theater. Yeah, there's a lot of information that is conveyed already unconsciously to you through your senses, through the feeling of the space, through the perceptual information. And it already sets you up to agree or disagree, to be open to the message or not, to understand it in a soulful way, or to just understand it in an intellectual way, to be able to respond to it, to enter a dialogue with it. All of that is first carried by the structure.
And actually, it is so sort of the when I look at the sets for a number of the operas that you've done, you tend to have, as best I can tell, you tend to work with set designers who are about as far away from a traditional set as one can get to.
they're mostly at heart, even if they don't know it, some of them, and some very consciously know it, they're either installation artists or architects before they are set designers in the whatever the stereotype of that is.
Well, let's dive into that. That's clearly been a choice of yours throughout your career. And I can only imagine that because, you know, and everyone, Francisco is being extremely patient with me because basically he knows he's dealing with a Philistine here. But that's okay because I and his brother Juan is also a Philistine, so he's got plenty of experience around it. But I am the kind of person who gets, you know, anywhere between annoyed, shocked, turned off, and maybe in 5% of the time, openly curious when I see a set that is unexpected, when I see that this is not the way the opera was conceived of by the original writers, because they couldn't have even have imagined this stuff. And that's a conscious choice by you, and I'm certain that you get this reaction from X percent of the audience. Could you take me through, us through, what attracts you to those sets, and how you plan to deal with the negative reactions?
But you said what I expect, yes? So expectation is the biggest killer of any kind of growth ever in anything, yes? The moment you expect something, you're closed to what you're really going to get. And unfortunately, in life, you never get what you expect in any part of your life, be it in love, in work, in anything, ever. Nothing is ever what you expect it to be. And if it is, it's boring and very unenriching, because it's what you already expect, you already know it. So what's the point in that? But the point is not to shock. Obviously, it's not to shock to do this. And the point is not even to surprise. It's sincerely to better convey the message of the piece. And I have no idea what the composer had in mind at the time. I didn't live in his period. Mostly they're dead. And when I have worked with living composers, they usually have an idea of what the show should be that is totally A, impractical, or not really good, because they're good composers and not necessarily good theater people. And if they are, maybe beyond budget or whatever. So there's like a million reasons that make you, choose how to express the meaning of a piece. And because I'm talking about structure all the time, and I find that's the most important thing, I always find that the space that I create on a stage with a designer needs to be the space that's going to enable me to put the audience in the right emotional state and the right intellectual state to receive whatever this cathartic message they have to receive at any given moment in the pieces. So I'm actually guiding them the same way I talked about an architect, guiding you through his design, through what you have to do in a building. I am guiding, I'm a director, I guide people through what it is they're meant, I think, to experience through the evening of experiencing this piece. Of course, unfortunately, I can only make them experience what I think they need to experience. I can't, everybody will experience something slightly different or would want to experience something slightly different. And the composer is yet another one. So all I can do is say, this is what I feel when I hear this piece. And through my experience, maybe there's something universal for you to experience as well, if you come with me. And I try to kindly invite you to come with me. And I don't think my shows are the kind of opera productions that block people. I really think, and I really work hard to make them extremely accessible. So even though the set may not be what you expected, I think that if you sit there, you actually will immediately understand what it means, and you'll be given the tools to engage with it and go into it and come out the other end having lived through some kind of emotional arc.
And in one of the...
And I think if you don't, I think it's due to this expectation that is blocking you. But that I can't help you with. You see what I mean? That's
Francisco, there's a lot you can't help me with, unfortunately.
I mean, if you go to the theater, you have to go open. If you go to a movie, if you go read a book, what's the point if you don't go open? It's like with any conversation. So I very often I don't understand politics at all, because the whole premise of the political conversation is to not be open to what the other one's going to say and staunchly defend your own position, which is the opposite of what a conversation is. So, but I understand the necessity, but it's very hard for me to participate in that kind of conversation. And unfortunately, very often when one of the weird things about opera is, as a director, unlike theater or film, you don't choose really the people that you work with. You know, a director of a play will spend ages auditioning, as will the director of a film. There'll be, you know, endless casting process to find just the right person to be in that role and everything. Whereas in opera, we mostly get given a cast and get given a conductor to work with. And the only people we really choose are our direct creative team of the designer, lighting designer, choreographer, costume designer. So a lot of the time I'm in these political conversations where I'm trying to convince or trying to, you know, understand what the other person expects. And it's a real problem in opera, because it means that the whole first weeks of the process are this learning to work with each other, rather than immediately together collaborating towards something, you know, that will be our communal work.
One of the videos that's on your website talks about the background to this Verdi's opera Jerusalem, and for the listeners or viewers' interest, it just shows the extraordinary amount of thoughtfulness that goes behind how the set mirrors the development of the characters. And this is a big opera with a lot going on, and it actually makes me very curious to see the opera, having seen that introductory video. But actually, I think that your view would be that the audience don't have to notice what's going on with the set. Your goal is to complement the drama and the music and to evoke certain sentiments inside the audience, which there's an extraordinary amount of depth of work, of thought that goes into it, I guess.
Yes, you know, I personally have a little problem with a lot of contemporary art, as in plastic art. Yeah, you don't say that in English, no? Is that plastic?
That's okay. I
visual
gotcha.
Visual arts.
Urinals on walls.
Or fashion as well, because very often what you're looking at only gains meaning once you read the program note, as it were, or right. The indication under the painting, the title of the painting, or the program that accompanies the fashion show, or whatever. It's these thoughts that are required to engage with the piece, and it becomes a purely intellectual process. And very often, you know, in opera, especially in Europe and particularly in Germany, there is a lot of focus on the intellectual work that surrounds the production and what's going to go into the program. There's, you know, there's actually a person called a dramaturg who will spend ages, you know, researching the right articles and interviewing me and that to create the program, to have this whole intellectual construct that accompanies the production. And I find it very difficult to engage with all of that, because I really want the piece to exist on the night in the number of hours that it lasts. I think you have to arrive not knowing anything, have enough information given to you by the show itself, so that you come out the other end having had a good experience, a useful, interesting, engaging experience. And then if that has titillated you in a way that you're going to want to know more about, I don't know, the period or the whatever the philosophy is around the piece or the historic event it's based on or whatever, or the visual aspects, you can go and do the research. And then maybe that program helps you do that. But if you need the program note, I think I have failed as an artist, because my medium is the show. My medium is not the program. Yeah. So my medium is not an intellectual discourse about my production. My medium is the sensual, primarily sensual and secondarily intellectual experience that you have in the theater.
Do you think, so I would go further and say that, do you think it's fair to ask, for me as an audience, to ask of you, a professional in opera, that the show meets its highest goals when the audience comes out transformed in some way, having lived through something and with something having changed inside them.
Absolutely. That's the whole point of any art. You experience it, and after experiencing it, you've changed. I don't know what that change is. It can be all sorts of different types of change. It can be that you have a new thought, that you want to learn something afterwards, or that you've connected with some emotion you don't usually have, or you've realized the plight of some side of society you've never thought about, or you suddenly have a more metaphysical view about certain aspects, or simply you've just vibrated, and as in vibrating, you've been conscious of being alive, form of meditation, if you like, of a guided meditation through music and drama and people moving on stage, a way of shaking your atoms and molecules, like when water boils.
So I'm going to poke you again now, because the one set of operas that I committed to, because I really did enjoy it when I lived in New York, was to watch, go through the Ring cycle that I've done, I think 3 or 4, maybe even 5 times in my life. First of all, I did fall in love with the music, but what really got me into it was when I understood that the characters on the stage were archetypes, and that I could engage in a form of psychotherapy, because what was up on the stage, when I see Wotan, it's the side of me that wants to conquer. And when I see the gods, it's the people who want to control. So you can, and so I kind of like felt like, the music certainly complements that. And so when these characters come up on stage, I can take out those sides of my personality and mm-hmm. work with them. And so really kind of like it really is an experience for me when I do it, when I commit to doing it. But Francisco, I did not see when I opened up the Wikipedia page, when will you conduct a Wagner? And I guess that might be a question that you're asking, but why has that not happened?
People ask you to do things, you know, it's not like in movies or in theater where a director will probably, you know, have a project they want to do, and they will, you know, go into discussions with a theater company and they'll, you know, we want to work with you. What would you like to do? How does this fit into our programmation and all of that? Or a film, you know, you have this project and you sell it to somebody, to a studio, whatever. It doesn't work like that in opera. In opera, you get a call saying, you know, we the opera company of so and such place, has decided that in 3 years' time we're going to do Carmen, and we probably already booked, you know, singer number X and conductor Y to do it. Would you like to direct it? And so it's very strange, because already you're working with pieces that already exist. Mostly, there are exceptions, because sometimes you work on new pieces, but or pieces that have never been done, which is the same as a new piece. But mostly, the great majority of the time, you're working with standard repertoire. And so suddenly you're presented with these pieces that already exist by composers who are dead, mostly, and librettists who are dead. And what your job is, and this is very strange and it's different from most other media, your job is to be an interpreter of that piece. So a singer is, you give a singer a song, the singer interprets the song remains, and it's the interpretation of that song that is going to be the piece of art that the audience is witnessing that night. And that also happens with the director in an opera. We are interpreting an existing piece, but then it gets very confusing, because where a singer doesn't change the song, just, you know, interprets it, I have to create a world for this interpretation, because it doesn't exist. There's a few indications on a piece of paper, but that doesn't tell you even 1/10 of what you need to know to put it on. Plus, you're doing it in a different period from when it was written, you know, with the people, the audience having completely different sets of philosophical thinking, theater conventions. Everything is different, just the way everything is different. So you have to suddenly create a world. And within that world that you're creating, that is new, you are interpreting an existing thing. So it's this really weird mixture of things. And I think if I'm any good at it, it's precisely because what we were saying at the very beginning of this conversation, I am quite chameleonic, and I enjoy being open to and immersing myself in other cultures, ways of thinking, languages, media, etc. And I like the mix of media and all of this. So I enjoy forgetting myself inside the existing piece, and then from that, having the freedom to then create something to then convey that piece to other people. And I think that's why I like opera more than any other medium, because it enables me to do both things at the same time.
Well, you know, I'm just going to put this request out to the universe and see what happens. You never know. I would like for the universe to create the circumstances in which this Francisco Negrín directs a new production of The Ring Cycle. And I think that the world deserves...
But you know, I don't know if the world deserves that, but certainly I think the same, that it's odd that nobody's asked me to do that, because it is actually a repertoire that totally fits my way of doing theater. And the other repertoire that does that is the French Baroque repertoire, composers like Lully and Rameau, that are the most famous ones. And nobody has ever asked me to do that. And yet I was like born to do that. It's exactly the format, the medium that I am good in. It's the language that I dominate most because it's in French. And somehow it never happens. And I most often get asked to do Italian bel canto, which is the opposite. So it's strange that either the universe, if we're going that way, wants me to bring my vision to the pieces that aren't necessarily most apt to it, which is quite interesting. Well, and maybe that's a good thing.
Well, maybe this little conversation will kind of like send the right signals to the right
maybe
the right actors. So a country that we're both connected to, Mexico, and I have deep frustrations with Mexico, which I feel like is a country that is struggling to awaken psychologically and has not quite succeeded, and it will eventually, but it would be nice if we could bring that process forward by a couple of hundred years. I happen to think that, so if I could have every woman in Mexico read Anna Karenina, I believe that it would do an enormous amount for women's rights in Mexico, which I think are in the dark ages. I think that that there's an awakening there, that women need to understand that women are in chains in Mexico and they don't realize the way they're in chains. And I think that book, simply describing the gross injustices that Anna Karenina had to go through in Russian society, would awaken them. I happen to think, and I think we had a conversation about this probably over WhatsApp, where you poo-pooed my idea, but I had this dream of bringing some version of The Ring Cycle to a mass audience in Mexico. And because I happen to believe that if it's psychotherapy for me, then it's also psychotherapy for other people, if they realize it or not, and to allow people to engage with these very powerful forces and to give people the space and the medium to do it can be transformational in the right circumstances. I don't know if you want to comment on that, but...
No, I think, of course, transformational, definitely. The problem there is simply cultural. I'm very aware of this. You know, when I do a show in France, or I do a show in Germany, or I do a show in the States, and also in what space I'm doing the show, I cannot make the same show. I can, you know, when you make a movie and then it gets shown in very similar cinemas all over the world. And people are used to seeing, well, actually not that used to seeing films from all around the world, a bit more so now with Netflix. So somehow they have the habit of watching these things, and hence the grammar, the tools to understand them. Whereas, you know, if you throw Wagner onto an unsuspecting audience in Mexico, it'll be like, you know, me coming and speaking Chinese to you now in this interview, you know.
You see, there's a big part of me that wants to believe, or maybe it's not Wagner, maybe it's Aida or something.
But you could do a musical theater that'll convey the kind of message you want to convey, and in a language that they will immediately understand, and that's when it'll be powerful.
The idea would be that this art form stands on its own, and it's so powerful that that even an audience that doesn't understand what goes around it will be, or a sufficient number will be instantly touched.
No, and I think that, yeah, you will touch some people immensely. Yes. But it just comes down to the conversation too of, I don't think opera should be made popular, because it's not a popular art form. It requires a certain amount of education and knowledge and desire to be received. It's complicated and sophisticated. And there are other forms of music theater, which, as you know, I put into the same medium, that do not require all of that. And that doesn't mean it's elitist, by the way, because you can, elitist seems to refer to money or social class. And, you know, you can be poor and of a lower social class and have all the culture in the world. And in fact, most of the people I know in upper classes and rich have no culture whatsoever. So
he's referring in part to me there, just in case you're interested.
That wasn't actually.
Just a little bit.
No, come on. You've mentioned Marshall McLuhan and Wagner in one single interview. You're fine.
That was just, so even worse, we won't get Francisco into it, but even worse is the people who mug up on one or two things and then just pretentiously not drop a few names.
Oh my God.
You've had plenty of those in your life, I'm sure.
But so then opera is not elitist. And first of all, what opera? You know, because I think there's some opera pieces, and especially performed in a certain way, that could be shown to absolutely anybody. And there's some, like probably The Ring Cycle, that can't, because they just have too many references to too many things, you know. So I think it's not elitist, but it is sophisticated.
Yeah. So we could dive into many places. I want to get onto talking about lowbrow, non-cultural stuff. I want to get onto the business mm-hmm. side of what you do. And I find it interesting that many of the interviews with you kind of want to get into the cultural side, which is no doubt interesting. But there's a business side, which I think, I recently referred Francisco to a friend of mine who's writing about business leaders. And I think there's extraordinary leadership that goes on. And it seems to me that one of the first acts of leadership that you had, Francisco, is that you had a safe job at the Brussels Opera. And you kind of left that after 2 years and became an entrepreneur in a certain way. I mean, you put yourself into extraordinary uncertainty with no guarantee of success. I mean, you know, within a year or two, you were directing at least one successful show in London. But in another version of that decision to leave the Brussels Opera, you might have ended up working as a stagehand in London. And I was hoping that you could take us through that decision, how you managed to make it, and why it ended up a success.
Well, again, it wasn't a decision, I don't think. I mean, if I was an assistant director at the Brussels Opera, it's because, you know, I really wanted to, I felt I wanted to work in music theater. And I followed the only path I could follow, which was to be the assistant of another director and learn, you know, through making. And one thing led to another. And as I really wanted to be a director, and I wasn't going to be getting offered a director position within the opera company that I was an assistant in, I had to simply go out into the world and start directing. So it's not like it was a decision. It was a necessity. And it turned out well, thank God. And that's partly chance, I suppose, too. I mean, you know, I know many people who are extremely talented, singers in particular, who are completely wonderful, who have absolutely no career because they just weren't in the right place at the right time and have the right contacts, didn't strike the zeitgeist in the right way at the right time, and no career at all, whereas lots of singers that are not very good that have amazing careers. And I have to say, I know lots of people better than me and as good as me and worse than me that have amazing careers because they're amazing entrepreneurs, and I'm not. And I really admire when an artist can also be an incredible entrepreneur. Though I do find that the entrepreneurial side ends up eating a little bit into their creativity and And hence, I tend to admire more the ones that keep the balance towards the art, even if it means sacrificing a little bit of the ambition the entrepreneurial side would enable them to satisfy. But I'll give an example. A really good example is Dali, the painter. He was an extraordinary painter, extraordinary technician, and extraordinary visionary. And he was an extraordinary entrepreneur. He created a brand. He created a physical brand for himself, mustache, the way of talking, which wasn't his normal way of talking at all. And the way he sold his art, the way he employed people to sell his art, was this massive business, a very, very successful business. I would say Andy Warhol is another example of this. Madonna is another example. You know, there are lots of these. I have a colleague, a designer, Es Devlin, that I've done lots of shows with, who's now also a director herself. And she's an extraordinary entrepreneur of her own brand and creator of her own brand. And it's a real talent, and it's one I don't have. And I wish I did a bit more, but not too much. And I'm glad that, you know, if I'm going to be balanced one way or the other, I'm glad I'm balanced the way I am rather than the other way.
Well, I think that the world may be coming your way because I think there's an authenticity to the way you approach it. And I don't know any of those people, but I think that the danger and what you're getting at is that there's not only is there a loss perhaps of creativity, there's a loss of authenticity of who they are, because now they have to, I mean, essentially they create a mask for themselves, and they create a mask, and we know all about masks and not reality.
Yeah. So. And there's a more practical thing. It's a question of time. You know, you can only really excel at something if you're completely given to it. You know, you completely give your live life to it. Yeah. So the true geniuses, the truly excellent people at anything, are completely obsessed with what they do and do only that at the detriment of their family life, their health, etc., etc. And if you're going to be excellent at being an artist and being an entrepreneur, there's just not enough time and energy for that, you know? So one will necessarily suffer.
I'm going to just read out what, it's an article from a while ago, but just to give you a sense of why, and it's kind of magic for me, because I know all this, so this is how a Scottish article wrote about Francisco. They write about your work, Francisco, that you are motivating the chorus, negotiating extra stage rehearsal time from the crew, placating designers and soothing the egos of divas and star soloists, while trying to breathe life into an art form that many believe is beyond redemption, and all without invoking the wrath of the maestro conductor. It's amazing what some people will do for their art. Does that describe your work when you're in production?
Yes, I mean, we were talking about this before. It is an art form that is interpretation at the same time as creation. And it is also leadership in that you're directing, not the piece, but you're directing all the people that are collaborating on it. And so there's a lot of psychology, there's a lot of politics, unfortunately, that I was describing before, that go into putting on a show. If you're a writer and you sit at home, you know, you're just writing a novel, then probably you have to deal with the editor afterwards. But still, you know, mostly you're writing on your own. If you're a sculptor, you know, you probably have to get money from somewhere to buy the materials and please whoever's commissioned you, but mostly you're sculpting your sculpture, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas at the other end of the spectrum, what I do, it cannot exist without my collaborators. I cannot do an opera on my own. I need musicians to play the music. I need singers to sing. I need designers. I need carpenters, electricians, cleaning ladies in the theater. I need a whole bunch of people to be doing this with me. And hence I'm an interpreter, a creator, and a manager of some sort.
So, I guess, you know, I have to bring this conversation to a close because part of the audience, this is so much fun for me because I get to hang out with Francisco once every like 5 to 10 years. But this is really kind of selfish because I've gotten to ask Francisco a bunch of questions that it kind of like weird if we were just having lunch. So in any case, I think that I have a bunch of sort of like fun sort of quick fire questions, like, you know, getting you to talk about favorite works of art, novels, writers. But if you could just sort of like, I guess it's kind of a summary, you know, to describe. So you have a North Star, which helps you prioritize things in your life. For example, prioritizing between being a good showman like Salvador Dali and being true to your art. How, you know, if you were to write your personal professional mission statement, which represents what you're aiming for, how would you describe that?
To hopefully be able to channel something that's in tune with what surrounds us. So it sounds a little bit new agey and metaphysical, but it's true. I do want to be able to, as an artist, vibrate in the right way with the piece I'm putting on, with the audience I'm putting it on for, with the collaborators I'm collaborating with, and somehow manage to channel all of this through the right vibration so that what comes out is alive and not stillborn, and that alive, it can vibrate and have some kind of beneficial impact.
Yeah, and what I would say is that, you know, and I'm not going to express this very well, but every successful civilization has the people who move the civilization forward. And we see in history and in art history how many things that unfolded were kind of foretold by the artists of the previous period. And I think that what I believe is that if people like me pay close attention or closer attention to the art that is being created, I will somehow be more alive and be better prepared for what is already unfolding. You're kind of like the soothsayers in a certain way, the nervous system, the I don't know exactly how to describe it, but there's something really important there. It's at the core of our cultural DNA or our operating system. And
yeah, I mean, when you look at, you know, all the religions of the world, or, you know, like, they all describe sort of creation events that are unbelievably similar to the ones that science is revealing as most probable, you know, big bangs and things. There's the greatest, we talked about this already before, the greatest advances in science have been made by intuition. In other words, a scientist has had a vision that has come from somehow being in tune to channeling something from somewhere else. I don't mean from aliens, but, you know, just vibing with everything around, you know, being in tune. And from there, this amazing thing that we have, that we seem to be the only objects in the known universe that have this, which is this intuition and consciousness of that intuition, and be able to act on it. And then scientists will then, you know, act on intuition and then verify it and build from there. Artists will act on that intuition and create. And that should be applied to everything. And the moment we stop listening to that ability we have to, again, to be in tune with the surroundings, then we cannot progress.
And I'm sort of like, one thought that I'll share with you, Francisco, I've been reading a lot of Jordan Peterson, and, you know, science, as much as it has progressed today, tells us what we think is out there. But science has not yet been able to tell us what to do about it. And the realm of religion, and I would argue the realm of art, is all addressing, is categorizing the reality that we see or the world out there and trying to help address what we do about it. And that is not obvious from, or not, there are some aspects like survive and thrive, probably the science would tell us that we really ought to do that. But many other questions about what we ought to do as individuals that there are no real answers for. And so that's why it's important. I want to just go through, and this is really just for fun, you know, to ask you to talk about a composer, an opera, a novel. And the question is, you know, I've got it down here as favorite... but really, the question is, you know, in this circumstance where you're talking to your friend Guy in a podcast format, where the audience is the audience that you sort of expect it to be, what is the thing that comes up that you think is most relevant? And so I'll just start with, I have to start with opera. What opera work comes to mind as relevant in this conversation for the listeners of this conversation?
I mentioned before the French Baroque composers like Rameau, because they truly take to the limit the idea of opera as a sensual, cathartic expression of the human condition. They require dance, pop divertimenti in the middle of the more serious parts of the opera. They require machinery. If there had been video at the time, I'm sure they would be using it, because it is truly multimedia work. And the subject matter is pure metaphysics. It's all, as you were talking about before, you know, when you understood that characters in Wagner were archetypal, that was really present in the Baroque period and then got lost for the 19th century and is coming back now. Really, opera was meant to be metaphorical and present archetypal characters for us to be able to really connect to deeper, more essential things. So I would say that, to me, yeah, the composer that really brings all that together, along with really delectable melodies and rhythms and in a really joyful and moving way, would be Rameau.
And for the listeners' interest, for all of my friendship with Francisco, an interest in opera, I have not listened to one Rameau opera. So it took a freaking podcast episode with Francisco to get that idea into my head. I apologize. I'm going to go listen.
You have to go listen to Hippolyte et Aricie by Rameau. Yeah. And it used to be totally unknown. And it's really only in the 20th and 21st centuries the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century, that it's really entered the repertoire. And it's entered the repertoire now because now, you know, through what we see in film and series, you know, all this, you know, all the fantasy superhero stuff, you know, we are very, very into metaphorical, archetypal type storytelling. We're not seeing so much, you know, social, political work being done in film and TV. It's stories that take us beyond to more essential stuff. You know, we're more in the world of Jung than of Freud at the moment.
Yeah.
And that's what these operas did.
So I'm looking forward to that very much, especially after my Wagner comments. I guess I'm going to ask you for, again, I actually hate it when people do this to me. It's like, well, what's your favorite novel? It's like, well, how long is a piece of string?
Well, because it changes.
Yeah. So my question to you is, name a novel that for this, for the uncultured audience that is likely to listen to this, would, like, what comes up for you as being something? And Rameau is fascinating. I mean, I'm looking forward, and I'll get back to you once I've at least listened or watched. But what's the novel that you think is relevant in this conversation to bring up?
It's not a novel. It would be a science book.
Okay.
Anything by Stephen Hawking or Carl Sagan.
Okay, so you don't even want to try.
Well, no, because I would have to really think about it. It takes me more than.
So
what came to mind? Yeah. Funnily enough, but it's maybe quite interesting to answer this. What came to mind was Frank Herbert's Dune, the science fiction novel.
Yeah, which I haven't.
The film has just been made of. It's an extraordinary thing because it allies. Oh, you know what? No, I have an even better example of something very similar. It would be this book that's meant to be for adolescents, called His Dark Materials by Philip Pullman, that has been made into many film attempts and series attempts as The Golden Compass and other names like that. His Dark Materials by Philip Pullman. It's this three-volume saga, but, you know, like Lord of the Rings or something. But it's an extraordinary riff on science and art and philosophy and religion all blended into one. in a way that adolescents can understand, but in a way that really is educational and takes them way further into thought than you would think an adolescent would take you.
So,
and as we're all adolescents, because human beings are very, very, very young, I think that would be the best thing to read right now.
So what's fun about that is that I don't know if I'd sent a Francisco set of questions to prepare with. He may not have come up with that. So there's often stuff that comes up like that. Mm-hmm. What you also just got a little bit of a taste of is that you can see that Francisco lives in a world that is far more nuanced and has far more depth than the one that I live in. But it's very genuine. Francisco's got a lovely brother who has more of a life and a business experience like I do. So Francisco's got plenty of experience of dealing with people like me, but you can also sense that he's got a sense of, that he kind of also laughs at the world that's on the other side of the looking glass, if you like.
Well, and so my brother is actually a painter and lives with an artist. So he's a little bit
so tainted. That's Francisco's way of saying, no, it's just you on your own, guy. You're the only Philistine around. Even my brother's got a little bit of it, you see. But I think that the dialogue between the two is also utterly fascinating. And I think that it's really wonderful that this medium of podcast allows us to do these kinds of conversations. And I'm really curious to see what happens when this podcast gets released into the wild, as they say. Last thoughts from you, Francisco. And if somebody, I will just tell you, and they'll be in the show notes, Francisco has a wonderful website that he shares with his brother. He's also got a very good Wikipedia page. And those of you who are opera lovers will obviously know about him. But it's fun to follow somebody who's so extraordinarily accomplished and at the same time so unknown because he works behind the scenes. And it's been a pleasure to talk to you, Francisco. Last thoughts from you.
I don't know. Go to the theater. Listen to music. Go to the movies. And maybe don't try to answer all the questions. Just feel what you feel when you go through these experiences, and go deeper into things. I would say, you know, not everything can be brought down to a 10-minute thought. You know, so let's give ourselves time to experience things, to grow.
Thank you so much, Francisco. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Same for me. Thank you, guys, for having me here.